Welcome to the sermon series of Paley Presbyterian Church. The following sermon is by guest speaker Shane Claiborne.
Please join me in welcoming Shane Claiborne.
Here, and I should say that, you know, I know Tony Campolo has been here a time or two. He's been a dear friend, and we kind of lead this Red Letter Christians thing together. But I should tell you where it kind of came from is one of our friends was being interviewed on the radio by a guy that, it was this radio DJ that didn't seem to have a whole lot to do with Christianity, but the DJ said to our friend, he said, "You know, I read the Bible. There's parts of it that I find really confusing, even troubling. But there's parts of it that I just love. And I've always loved the stuff in red. You should call yourselves Red Letter Christians because you seem to like that stuff too." And so we kind of stuck. And we've embraced the word, you know, the idea of Red Letter Christianity, living like Jesus meant the stuff he said. And, I mean, the black letters are important, too, but my friend says, you know, Jesus is the lens through help that we can understand the whole Bible and we can understand how we're to live in the world. So we're trying to live as if Jesus meant that stuff. And I thought this morning I would start with the words of Jesus in one of his stories. And it's one that may be familiar to some of us if you haven't been a part of the church or maybe not read the red letters much, it may be new to you, but it's a beautiful story, and Jesus told it like this. It's in Luke chapter 10. A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he fell into the hands of robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. Now a priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too a Levite, when he came to the place, saw him and passed by on the other side. But then a Samaritan came, and as he traveled, he passed where the man was. When he saw him, he had compassion on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on him oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey and took him to an inn where he could take care of him. The next day, he took out 2 silver coins and gave them to the innkeeper and said, "Look after this man, and when I return, I'll reimburse you for any extra expense you have." Which of these 3 do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? Well, that's the word of Jesus, and I think there's a lot of things we can take out of this story. The first for me is that people get beat up at really inconvenient times, you know, and 2 of the folks didn't have room for the interruption. They passed by, and I think I used to give those guys a hard time and think, you know, they were probably late to a board meeting or something or a trustee meeting at church, but they passed by. We don't know why. You know, as I look closer, maybe it's because they were scared. You know, I mean, here's a guy who's been beat up, and they don't know where the robbers are, and for whatever reason, I guess they're more concerned about what would happen to them if they stopped. But the Samaritan, right, was more concerned about what happened to this guy if he didn't stop. And he was, the most unlikely hero. I think some of these stories Jesus told were so scandalous, you know, because you have these 2 folks that represented everything religious in the world, a priest and a Levite, an expert in the law. And yet, as religious as they were, their faith did nothing to compel them to act in compassion to the person that had been beat up, right? And then you have a Samaritan who was ostracized, stigmatized for a couple reasons. 1, because of he didn't have all the orthodox beliefs. The Samaritans notoriously had some unorthodox theology. They didn't believe all the right stuff. He was also an inter-ethnic group of folks. And so they were stigmatized by that. So by every means, they were on the margins. And yet, this is the person who did something, right? Who acted in compassion. And so Sister Joan Chittister, this wild, sassy nun, she says, "Jesus can consistently challenges the chosen and includes the excluded, right? And Jesus makes heroes like this Samaritan man. They become the heroes of the story. So the other thing that strikes me as we read the story is that we don't know much about the man that got beat up, do we? All that we know is that he was a human being. We don't know where he was from or what religion he was or what his sexual orientation was. All we know is that he was a child of God. And experts show that the two ways that we could have identified him were taken from him. One, he was knocked unconscious, so they couldn't hear the accent and the language. And then he was stripped of all of his clothes, so we couldn't see, identify, you know, by what he was wearing, what tribe he might have been a part of, where he's from. All we know is that he mattered to God. And so I look at this story and I look at my own life and it becomes sort of a mirror. You know, I think I could have spent a lot of my life separate from the suffering of the world. You know, this story would have never happened if people weren't walking down a road where people still get beat up. And yet everything in our world is moving us away from the streets where people get beat up, right? Moving us away from neighborhoods where there are people that don't look like us, right? Where violence might still be a struggle. And I think like the trajectory of our life often moves us away from suffering. And yet the gospel is a call into the trenches, right? It's a call to get into the suffering of the world. Mother Teresa was one of those folks that taught me that. Because, you know, I started going to college and asking, okay, who really lives this out? Mother Teresa was one of those folks that just caught my fascination. You know, she seemed to go a different trajectory and went to what she called the poorest of the poor. And one of the things that I got to spend some time with in India with Mother Teresa, and one of the things that she talked about is how it can be very fashionable to talk about the poor and still not know them. If we really care about the poor, we know their names. And I began to realize that, you know, even in the church, a lot of times we've moved away from the poor. In my senior year of college, I did a survey where I asked folks who all profess to be strong Christians. I asked them, did Jesus spend much time with the poor? And like 95% of them, almost all of these folks said, yes, Jesus spent time with the poor. Well, later in that little study, I asked them, do you spend time with the poor? And of that group, like less than 5% said they had any meaningful relationships with people in poverty. And I realized Mother Teresa was right. It can be fashionable to talk about the poor and not fashionable to talk to them. Right? We can care about justice in a big sense. We can compartmentalize our charity and still not have meaningful relationships. So I think this story became one of those that compelled me to move to lean in to the suffering of the world a little bit, right? I got involved in Kensington, the neighborhood where we've lived for the last 20 years. Ironically, it began with an interruption. I was going to Eastern, not too far from here, and in 1995, back in the 1900s, we were going to school, and one of my friends says, you're not going to believe this, check it out. He threw a newspaper down, and the front page of the newspaper was the story of these homeless families in Kensington, mothers and children who had no place to go. There were 3,000 families on the waiting list for housing. And they looked around North Philadelphia and they see what we still see today. There are over 25,000 abandoned houses at the same time that there are folks waiting for years and years for affordable housing. And so these families did something courageous. They found a space that they could move into. And it wasn't just any space. It was an old sanctuary that belonged to the Catholic Church. And they moved into it and they started living there. And sadly, as we read this newspaper article, it said that they had been given a 48-hour eviction notice, that they were being asked to leave, and if they didn't, they could be arrested for trespassing on church property. And there was something about that that just didn't quite feel right. You know, so we went down and we found on the front of this cathedral the families had hung a banner that said, how can we worship a homeless man on Sunday and ignore one on Monday. It's a place where I was really awakened, you know, and there were so many things that happened in there. But one of the following newspaper stories said, "Church resurrected," and it talked about how these families had brought this abandoned cathedral back to life again. And actually, I ended up getting married in there. You know, it's a special place to us, but it was there that we began to dream again about what it really means to be the church. And many of those families got housing, and we moved into the neighborhood around the corner from there, and that's been home for the last 20 years. It's a place that I find great hope, because even though there's a lot of abandonment and a lot of struggles, one of my neighbors said, "Our neighborhood is poised for resurrection." Like, this is a great place to believe that God is on the side of life, because there's a lot of things that would point another direction. So over the last 20 years, we've been resurrecting space. You know, we've been creating affordable housing for families like those we met 20 years ago. So we can get, the good thing about the great things we've got going for us is real estate is cheap, you know? So we can get houses for as cheap as a dollar. Not bad. Don't even need a loan, you know? And so we buy them for a dollar. And we work with each family to build their own home, you know. So we have houses we've gotten for a dollar, and families will put 350 hours or more into their own house. Our motto is, "We won't do it for you, but we'll do it with you." We team them up with builders, and we all kind of work together to resurrect these houses. And we do no interest loans, so all the money goes to pay off the mortgage. We don't sell any houses for more than $35,000. Some of you want to move in, just talk to me. You know, but I look at them as a part of a resurrection story. You know, we're planting gardens, and Becca just said we got chickens now. You know, we're seeing these abandoned lots come back to life. And one of my neighbors, she said, as we're, you know, we got raspberries and strawberries that you can walk through and just eat. And one of my neighbors said, "It feels like we're trying to bring the Garden of Eden to Kensington." Yes, that's good theology. Right? It's exactly what we're trying to do. And Jesus said we're to bring the kingdom on earth as it is in heaven, that we're trying to reimagine what God's dream would look like in our neighborhood. And we get to see stuff come back to life. We see praying mantises and butterflies. One of my favorite days was when one of the kids on my block was banging on our door. He goes, "Come here, come here, come here." I said, "What?" And I thought there was an emergency, you know. And he drags me down the block and he goes, "What is that?" It was a firefly, right? I'm like, that, my brother, was a great day for God. God was like, "I'm going to make a bug that's butt glows in the dark." And it's that, you know, sense of wonder. Like, that's what we get to do. We get to stand on the side of life with God. We saw our first cardinals that we've ever seen in 20 years this past year. We're seeing, like, life begin to flourish. But as I also think back to this story, it is a story where that involved an act of violence. You know, we live in a world so filled with violence, and we think of this young man who was beat up and left in the ditch, and we don't know his name, but he has a name, right? He has a name on our streets. He has a name. Just 2 days ago, you probably saw this in the news, 2 days ago, we had another shooting in our neighborhood. This is one block from where I live. A 2-year-old was shot 4 times in the back. And so these stories have names and faces, right, that affect us. And I think part of what we've got to do is we've got to lean into that suffering and allow it to affect us, right? To allow someone else's suffering to disturb our comfort a little bit, that we might actually be able to move closer to those who are in the ditch. Because I think proximity to pain matters. When we move further and further, it's hard to hear the cries of those who are hurting. And so that's why it makes so much sense that some folks cross to the other side. But we're actually, the gravity of the gospel takes us into the ditches, right? It takes us into the pain. And that also means, I think, you know, as we look at our community, we began by doing, bringing people in from the streets, you know, coming alongside homeless moms and families, and There does come a point where Dr. Martin Luther King, I think, is so right when he said, we're called to be the Good Samaritan and lift our neighbor out of the ditch. But after you lift so many people out of the ditch, you also start to ask, maybe we need to rethink the whole road to Jericho, right? We got to go up the road a little bit and figure out what's landing people in the ditch to begin with. And that's become a part of our work, too, is as we continue to do the work of compassion. We also were asking, like, how is it that people continue to get beat up and left in the ditch so much? And so one of the things that happened just a year or so ago is we had a shooting in the season of Lent, right before Easter. A young man, I remember hearing the gunshots, and I came out to my front step, and I saw him collapse, and I held his hand. He was still alive at the time. The ambulance came and they drove him off, and then we found out the next morning that he didn't live. His name was Papito. He's 19 years old. And I can remember as we began to think towards Easter and the promise that life triumphs over death, the tomb is empty, we decided to do something different. We moved our services into the streets. And so we had some services like the Stations of the Cross. We had them at the places where people had suffered violence. And it connected the suffering of Jesus to the suffering of our streets. And then one of the most powerful services we had was we did our Good Friday service in front of the gun shop that's a block from my house. And this isn't just any gun shop. It's one of the most notorious gun shops for selling guns that end up being used in violent crimes. And so we the young man in my neighborhood carried the cross, and they put it in front of the gun shop, and hundreds of us gathered, and we began reading the story of Jesus, right, as he died on the cross, and he cried out, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing, and the women were weeping at the foot of the cross, that passion narrative. But then, after we read the gospel, we invited the mothers who had lost their kids to share their stories. And something happened, you guys. I mean, it was like Calvary met Kensington. You know, the tears of those mothers 2,000 years ago met the tears of our mothers on our street. And this woman came up to me, and she was shaking, you know, tears rolling. She said, I get it, I get it. I said, what? And she said, I understand something today I've never understood so powerfully in my life. I said, what? She said, God understands my pain because God knows what it feels like to lose his son. And I realized it was Papito's mom. And I think that is something better than any of the theology, Becca, I learned at Princeton, right? I love Princeton, but that theology, God understands my pain because God knows what it feels like to lose a son. That's the gospel, when the gospel connects to the suffering and the pain of our world. And so we also, as we have begun to continue this work of resurrection, right, of life, we don't just stay in Good Friday, although it was a powerful service. We even had some rabbis that came and said, we don't usually come to Good Friday services, but we're excited about this, you know. But then we remember that, like, the trajectory of this is God stands on the side of life, right? God is about an empty tomb. And so we got inspired after that service to do by the great scripture of Micah and Isaiah, right? That God's people will beat their swords into plows, their spears into pruning hooks. That we will actually beat our weapons into things that can bring life rather than take it. And so I've got a couple of pictures here that they're going to throw up on the screen because they show that was our Good Friday service. On Good Friday outside the gun shop. But then the next ones you'll see, this is a powerful shot because this is a congregation that also began to lean into the suffering, and they put t-shirts out with the names and the ages of everyone that's died in Philadelphia that year. So a way of publicly lamenting the the loss of life. And every time they're going into worship, they're seeing the over 280 names and stories of those who have died. So I think to lean in means that we can begin to have imagination, right? Even with our space, as we think about the suffering of our cities. And so these kind of installations have happened in different places. But then as we moved on, we got inspired by this. And so we got some of our welders and blacksmiths together. We said, let's, if this is what God's doing, you know, the trajectory of history is that we're going to beat our swords into plows. Let's get at it. And so we invited people to, we got our blacksmiths here. You'll see a picture or so of them. And we invited people to donate their guns, right? Because the fact is we've got extras. we've got, you know, it's like 290 million or something. We've got one gun for almost every person in the U.S. And so we said, let's invite people that might get inspired by this to donate their guns. This was one of the first ones we got, an AK-47, right? This guy was like, I'm not sure why I have it. You know, he goes, you don't hunt deer with it. And I'm not sure anything good is going to come of it. So I want to repurpose that metal, and I want to turn it into a plow. So we took that. That's the original AK-47. You'll see the next one is a shovel and a rake that we made out of it. Come on, right? And so we got, like, it got contagious. People everywhere got excited about this. So we've done them all over the country now. But you'll see a few pictures here of guitars that were made out of handguns. And that really plays music. We'll have to get you one for the worship band. But then we had a fellow in Mozambique that sent a picture of a semi-automatic that he had turned into a saxophone. Right? He's playing music on it. And then I got this image from my friends in Iraq. I've had the privilege of traveling to Iraq a number of times and to build relationships and friendships there. And this is in Najaf. Some friends sent me a picture. They said, we got excited about this, you know, imagining a world free of violence. So we put all the guns in the street and we drove over them with a steamroller and crushed them. And they said, we wanted the kids to catch the vision for a world free of violence. So we let them drive. And you'll see, don't worry, their parents are with them. But they're driving and they're crushing those guns, right? Well, one of the most powerful services that we had is this next picture you'll see. We found a gun in one of the abandoned houses, right? And we took that gun and we heated it in the forge, as you'll see here. But then we invited the folks who had lost their loved ones, their children, mothers and fathers. And we even had a police chief that joined us. And we heated up that metal. We began to transform it. In the middle of that, this woman took the hammer. And she's got a picture of her son on her jacket who was killed in a random shooting at a movie theater here in Philadelphia. And Miss Ryan there, she took that hammer, she began to beat on that gun, and tears were rolling down her face. And with every strike of the hammer, she said, this is for my boy. I mean, there wasn't a dry eye. You know, it moved us. And we saw her begin just beating on that. And it felt like she was participating in something holy, right? Like this work of God of transforming a world filled with violence into a world full of life. And that day, you'll see that gun as it changed from what it was into what it is now. And now the barrel of that gun is a plow that we use in our garden. In fact, I brought it with me this morning, and I'll have it on the back table. You can hold it, and you can pray with those prophets, Micah and Isaiah, that we would beat our swords into plows. So there's this call to resurrection and to life. We have a God that stands on the side of life. And I think one of the most powerful things we can do today is be people that interrupt death and stand on the side of life consistently, right? It's one of the things I love about Mother Teresa. She's known to be a champion for life. And But sometimes people just think about abortion. And please, Mother Teresa was passionately against abortion. But that wasn't just about bumper stickers and t-shirts, right? She brought in 14-year-old moms. I met them, you know? She raised kids that were abandoned in train stations. Like, that's what it looked like to really be about ending abortion. But she also was against the death penalty. She was against militarism. She had a consistent life ethic. And I want to suggest that that's what I see happening in the church. I see young people in particular that are disenchanted with the political options because they don't see that consistent life ethic, right? That it's hard to find folks that are pro-life from the womb to the tomb, right? That are consistently standing against death and that are declaring that every single person is created in the image of God. And anything that kills someone or squashes someone's dignity is going against the grain of what the author of life is doing in the world. We are people of resurrection. And so I think that as we consider like what it means to be the light of the world, I want to read these words. This is from Justin Martyr, right? So just 100 years after Jesus was here in the flesh, he said these words. I love reading the words of the early Christians because they had that consistent ethic of life. Our brother Ron Sider wrote a book, The Early Church on Killing, where he goes through every different issue and how the early Christians spoke so passionately and authoritatively against killing in every form. And so this is Justin Martyr, 165 AD. We ourselves were well conversant with war, with murder, with everything evil. But all of us throughout the whole wide earth have traded in our weapons. We have exchanged our swords for plows, our spears for farm tools, and now we cultivate justice and kindness, the fear of God and faith, and the expectation of a future that is given to us through the crucified one, Jesus. So as we think of the work that you're doing, it is about interrupting death, right? The big day that you've been doing this weekend, it is about leaning into the suffering. And I'm convinced that we can't make poverty history until we make it personal. So I want to invite you to keep leaning into the suffering in Kensington. And the suffering that might even be closer than that, it might even be right around the corner, right? That all around us there is a groaning. As the scripture says, all creation is groaning. And I think God is inviting us to lean in, right? To lean in and join the redemptive work of interrupting everything that is killing our brothers and sisters on our streets and around the world. So I brought this little audio clip. I want to invite you to pray as a closing, but just to tell you, my trips, like when I've gone to Iraq and Afghanistan, they've changed me. I mean, I grew up in a military family. My dad was in Vietnam. The more I've gone to some of these areas, the more convinced I am that Jesus, you know, in the Sermon on the Mount, when he says, love your enemies, he meant we shouldn't kill them. You know, and I've been able to go and be with incredible groups of folks that are doing peacemaking work and have been inspirational to me. Doctors and nurses and pastors. The first time I was in Iraq was in March of 2003. So it was during the shock and awe bombing, the bombing of Baghdad. 900 bombs a day falling on Baghdad, and we were there. And we saw so many things, but we also saw the courage of Christians there in the face of such violence that continued to be faithful to Jesus. And one of those, we were invited to a worship service, and there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Christians from all different denominations together. And they read a statement that all the bishops had written to Muslim folks. It was addressed to Muslims, and it said, we want you to know that we love you. And we believe that you are created in the image of God, that we come from the same dysfunctional family of Abraham and Sarah. We love you. And then they said, and now we want to point to the cross and remind everybody that the cross teaches us a different way to deal with violence than by mirroring it, that we're to love even those who would want to hurt us, that we're to wear evil down with love. And they said, this cross doesn't make sense to smart bombs or to the wars or all that. They said, but this cross is what God is like. And everybody started singing Amazing Grace in Arabic. My Arabic's not great, so I just kind of hummed along. But I had tears rolling down my face, and as I listened to my brothers and sisters sing Amazing Grace in Arabic. And then after that, I came up to the bishop afterwards, and I said to him, I said, oh, brother, this has moved me. And I said, I had no idea there's so many Christians in Iraq. And the bishop goes, yeah, this is where it started. And I pointed out the window, and he goes, that's the Tigris River and the Euphrates. Have you heard of them? I said, you didn't admit Christianity in North America. You just domesticated it. He said, you go back and you tell them that we are praying for them. We are praying for the church to be a voice of conscience, a voice of nonviolence and of peace right now. Tell them we're praying for them. So I think we're reminded that what God is doing in the world is big, right? That this family is big, and many of us are suffering as we remember those all over the world who are suffering. I want to play this video clip, or this audio clip, because as the war was happening in Baghdad, our friends heard these kids. And these kids, not unlike your kids that were just up here, were singing. And I would never have recognized the song. He recognized it because he's a musician. But they were singing in Arabic. And then they began singing in English, the beautiful spiritual We Shall Overcome. So as we close, I invite you to listen to these, our brothers and sisters who are in Iraq, singing We Shall Overcome. And as we do it, I want to invite you to do something a little different. I promise it won't get too crazy up in here. You know, Presbyterian. I want to invite you to stand with me. And instead of looking here, I want to invite you to turn and look out the windows to the world out there, right? And let's listen to these young people sing We Shall Overcome. So stand as you're able to and look out the window. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they are the children of God. Make us peacemakers in a world so filled with violence. And as we look out the windows, we are reminded that you are not calling those who are suffering to find the church, but you are calling us to go into all the world. And so I pray for this beautiful community here at Paoli Press, that you would give them eyes to see and ears to hear those who are suffering. And give us all courage, Jesus, to move closer to the ditch and not pass by on the other side. Thank you for joining those who are suffering in our world and calling us to follow you. Give us courage. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.